Hello and welcome to Shout to the Top, a new monthly chat show on the award-winning NLive Radio. I'm your host, Nick Petford, and our theme today is policing. I'll be talking to the Chief Constable of Northamptonshire and experts from the university, all supplemented by a favourite song or two. Well, that was The Clash, and I fought the law, and now here is the law, or the man responsible for enforcing it in Northamptonshire. That's Chief Constable Nick Adley. Now, Nick grew up in Manchester, and after a stint in the Royal Navy, joined the Cheshire Constabulary as a police constable, working his way up to superintendent. After a break, he rejoined the force at Manchester, Greater Manchester, becoming chief superintendent, and in 2015 was promoted to assistant chief constable at Staffordshire. In August 2018, Nick was appointed chief constable of Northamptonshire Police. He also leads the National Police Chiefs Council for Disclosure and Safeguarding and Motorcycling and Criminal Use of Motorcycles. Nick, that sounds fantastic. I probably shouldn't say that.
Hello, Nick. Yeah, no, it is. It's a great portfolio to have because it encompasses police motorcycling as well. I've been a police motorcyclist now since 1992. And of course, the criminal use of motorcycles, we saw a surge of that in the metropolitan police area. So it's how we can get all forces to work together to try and deal with this particular issue. It's a great portfolio to have. Very, very interesting and doing some good stuff.
It is. Well, thank you. And also welcome to the show. I mean, let's get down, get our first lockdown question out of the way. Last month on Shout to the Top, we had Lucy Whiteman, Director of Public Health here at Northamptonshire, praising the role of the police locally in helping keep the infection rate lower than it might otherwise have been. But Nick, last April, you did cause a bit of controversy for comments you made on checking supermarket baskets to see if the items in them were legit. That did attract attention. In fact, it went up to the Home Secretary, I think, Piri Patel. Nick, the story seems to have media spin all over it. So what's your side of things?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Lucy for those kind words. I mean, she and her team are doing an equally fantastic job. And the last thing that I ever wanted to do was try and cause a stir or upset anybody at the thought that we were going to be stopping people and checking their baskets and their trolleys. It was media spin that was done for a quite obvious purpose, that they want the police to be the pantomime villain. At that time, they actually did. What I did say at that time was what we wouldn't be doing is checking baskets and trolleys because it is not up to the police to determine what is an essential item and what isn't. But what I did say was, and this is a bit that they swapped around, was that in terms of roadblocks and checking whether the journeys were essential, if people didn't start to follow the rules, then we would start to do that. That's what I actually said. It's also worth mentioning, Nick, that when I made that announcement, less than 10,000 people across the United Kingdom had died from COVID-19. And sadly, because a number of people have not followed the rules and perhaps haven't acted in the way that we would want them to have done, is that we're now at a figure of 120,500. So the fact that I made the comment that if people didn't start to follow the law and the rules and the guidance, that we would step up patrols and enforcement, I actually don't apologise for that. What I do feel bad about is the fact that people felt, because of the way the media spun it, that we were going to be searching supermarket baskets and trolleys and walking up and down aisles. That was never the case. And again, if I just put the record straight here, if I may, Nick, the Home Secretary never spoke to me. She was ambushed on a radio show, on talk radio, and what she said was, if those comments have been made, they are inappropriate. I've had conversations with the Home Office. They are more than content with the comments that I made when they've seen the live interview.
Thank you for putting your side forward, Nick. It's just shows you, doesn't it? Don't believe everything you read or hear. Nick, more broadly, in terms of COVID, is a game going to be a game changer for the police? Now, thinking really about the digital technologies, you know, I can imagine that working from home is not yet an option for the jobbing bobby, but new ways of working are appearing in all industries. And I read with interest that Essex Police now have a drone with its own Twitter account. We've got stuff like face recognition, surveillance cameras, artificial intelligence, big data. So how will these innovations change policing, I don't know, in the next 10 years or so?
Well, that's a fantastic question, because what I will say is that COVID tragic in many, many ways. But actually what it has done is it's created a number of opportunities, not just for the police, but in private industry as well, to look at the way that they provide the service. So we are now looking at how people work from home. We've been able to put IT into their houses, to put remote access in so they can do everything that they could do in the workplace now at home, which means that we can consider the size of our estate, which in turn will reduce costs in terms of obviously heating, lighting and buildings and so on, which can be reinvested into the frontline policing. In terms of things like drones, we already have a drone unit now that's set up and they are operating really effectively. And COVID has actually shown us that we can use that even more so in terms of patrolling those hotspot areas where we know that crime and antisocial behaviour is starting to take place. I think the other thing as well is that what we've been able to do through the time that COVID has given us is develop our own artificial intelligence and strategic demand analysis work. So we can now tell you where crime is likely to happen before it happens. Now, I know that's not a new concept, but for Northamptonshire Police, the technology to be able to do that at the push of a button is. So that is really exciting. There's more going to come out on that in the next few days. I think the thing that I will say, though, the point that I will make is that the public wants human interaction with their police. One of the reasons that I've invested heavily and gone large on increasing neighbourhood policing and will be doing over the next 2 years is that the public want a relationship with the police, and they want to see them on the beat, and they want to be able to have conversations with them as and when. And machines should never replace that, because I think we're entering into dangerous territory if we try and replace all, if you take the human out of the loop completely. So we will never move away from that side of it.
So we're not going to see like a RoboCop then, Nick, anytime soon.
Well, do you know, it's is it Amazon? They've now got these robots up and down the streets. And don't get me wrong, I think probably after I've long gone, there'll be holograms of police officers stood on bridges and street corners, I'm sure. But for now, the technology that we have is actually giving us greater accessibility and flexibility to be able to police through a number of ranges and disciplines, but gives the public the confidence that we're there and that we are approachable and connected.
So that's the future. Now, I don't know about you, Nick. I grew up in the 1970s, and I guess like many of us, my introduction to policing was initially through TV with Zed Cars, Dixon and Doc Green, and perhaps on the more gentle side, but also the Sweeney, DS George Carter and DI Jack Regan and DCI Gene Hunt in Life on Mars. So I mean, my reflections as a teenager was that the behaviour of those characters, and while none of us want to condone it, did capture, if you like, the commonplace violence of the time, the 1970s, which, I don't know, it seemed to be much more pervasive then, but less intense perhaps than it is now. So how do you think society has changed since then, and how have the police had to adapt to the more extreme levels of street violence we now see?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Gene Hunt, what a legend. I mean, depending on how well this interview goes, Nick, you may have to fire up the quattro, but let's hope not. I think what we have seen over the years, and certainly in my 29 years in policing, I have seen the changes in terms of tolerance, and I've also seen changes in terms of fear of the law. People don't fear the law. Most people are still very law-abiding, thankfully. It is a useful statistic that 95% of the public in Northamptonshire will never come into contact with the police, and that's good news. Amongst that 5%, there is an element of people who think that it is okay to act with impunity, that the level of violence that we are now seeing using knives and firearms has intensified significantly over the years. And I think that is just a number of things. One, around the criminal justice system per se, is there a deterrent? And that's a really academic question that many have studied. Is there a deterrent? Does it work? How do you get greater desistance through a criminal justice process? And I think that overall is that there is just this propensity, there's a lack of tolerance for certain things, where instead of the punch-up that you and I will be used to, that actually they will use weapons without a second thought and commit those crimes, without a moment's thought for the consequences that may follow. We are working hard here in the county to understand that. So in terms of the psychology around all of that and the actual hotspot areas where we tend to get, in terms of deprivation, it tends to be in the more deprived areas, why there is a greater lean towards using that level of violence and the level of weaponry that we're now seeing. And we are making some progress with that, but there's no question that it has to change. And I think this is a very controversial statement, but I've made it many times over the years. This starts at home. This starts at home in terms of good parenting, carries on then, or guardianship. It then moves on into schools. And I'm not having to go at the education sector here. I'm just saying that's where it carries on to make people good citizens. And I think a lot of the cuts over the years from 2008, certainly, in terms of supporting parents and getting it right at that very early stage, or supporting the guardians at the very early stage, needs a fresh look at. And we have to start again from there.
Nick, there's lots going on in Northamptonshire. I wanted to ask you about one of perhaps the most high-profile cases that you're working on, that's of Harry Dunn. And for any listener who doesn't know, Harry was killed in a motorcycle crash in Northamptonshire in 2019, where a suspect, the wife of a US intelligence officer, claimed diplomatic immunity and left the UK. Now, as I understand it, the suspect has been charged with causing death by dangerous driving, and an extradition process has begun. Is there an update?
Well, first of all, I want to make the point that we stand shoulder to shoulder with Charlotte and Tim. And funnily enough, I was on a conversation with the Police and Crime Commissioner just a few moments ago, and I was saying to him that it still is a sore point that we don't have anybody that has faced justice, and we have a 19-year-old who's lost his life on the roads of Northamptonshire. That does not sit comfortably with me. And we will work with Tim and Charlotte in any way that we can to see justice done. The update from the police inside is that it's pretty much done. There isn't a lot more that we can do now. We did the investigation. We presented the file of evidence. Thankfully, the CPS agreed with our recommendation, or my recommendation, that this should be a death by dangerous driving, and nothing less would do. And they did go with that. And of course, as we know, under whether she had diplomatic immunity or not, that's still a matter for the courts to decide. I find it sad and unfortunate that she left the country and didn't face the consequences of the actions, as tragic as the accident was. And now here we are, you know, a prolonged agony for the family. And of course, conversations are still going on with the US State Department, with the Crown Prosecution Service, and with the Foreign Office. And we will have to see. I mean, things are changing daily. And I hear the last thing that I read was that Anne Sekulis is actually open to some form of a resolution to try and help the family move forward. I'm not sure whether that would do that for me if I was Harry's dad or mum. But we wait and we watch with interest.
Yeah, very, very difficult situation for everyone. Nick, you're, let's talk about your style of leadership. I mean, so I've been a VC now for 10 years here, and I've seen three chief constables come through in my tenure with some overlap between us. And what I mean by that is when I started as the university, the chair of the university board, so my boss, technically, was also the chair of the former Northamptonshire Police Authority. And so David O'Dowd, one of your predecessors, was on my interview panel. So I've always felt a connection between both organisations. From what I've heard, morale is massively on the up in your force, and you particularly have embraced social media to an extent unheard of in forces elsewhere. So Nick, what are your thoughts on good leadership, and how difficult is it to innovate in such a highly scrutinised public service like the police?
Well, I think, first of all, there's two things. Is remembering what your purpose is. And I always see my purpose as a facilitator to allow the men and women of this fantastic force to police the county in the best way that they can. This is a great county, and the public here deserve the very best police service that we can give them. So the very first thing that I have always done in any position of leadership is find out what it is that the men and women of the force need to enable them to do the job that they joined to do. That's the first thing. So when I came here, there was a list as long as your arm, not all of it affordable, but working through that made sense. So you get a sense of what the staff need to be able to do the job that they joined to do. If they are happy in their work because they feel as though they are making a difference, then you're going to have a happy workforce and morale is going to lift. There's no question. The second thing, and I know it's an old one, this, but it's so true, show enthusiasm for the work that the people are doing. I joined police in to fight crime and protect people, and that ambition has never, ever changed. I didn't become a chief constable to become a scrutineer that would nail people to the floor if they didn't get everything right. And we don't get everything right. So show enthusiasm for the work, and when we get it wrong, hold our hands up, but support the staff where that's appropriate. And as I say, people, that will resonate with people. The bit about social media is so important to me because, and I know I can be quite controversial on there, but I do that on purpose. I am provocative sometimes for purpose, for my own reasons, to promote and prompt debate. So there's two things. One, let's get some debates going, because if things stay in the shadows, we never really know what's going on, and we go around thinking everything's fine and it isn't. And secondly, it allows the public to make contact with you. And, you know, I get as many things over Twitter as I do emails. I get hundreds and hundreds a week. But what that allows me to do, and I have to do, and I do all this in my own time, by the way, I don't use the public's money to finance my Twitter work. But I think it's really important that I am accountable to the public and that they have access to me And I can deal with things before, in many cases, before they become an issue. And if I may, Nick, I'll just give an example. Over the weekend, our officers did a tremendous job in terms of taking an uninsured, an untaxed, and an MOT'd vehicle off the road. Unfortunately, that vehicle belonged to a homeless individual, which and their choice, that's where they choose to live, and we have to respect their choice of living. Through social media, it caused an uproar. Through social media, I was able to deal with that within a matter of 2 hours, where the vehicle was placed off-road, so it was safe, no danger to him, the individual, or the public, and the public then think the police have done a really good job. Had we not had that access through Twitter, it had already got into the local media. That would have probably hit national headlines. That's the power of social media, and that's the impact and influence that we can have, and that's why I'm passionate about it.
But you also need to be quite, if I may say something, quite brave to be engaging in the way that you do, because let's face it, social media is a bit of a nightmare out there. You say the wrong thing inadvertently or whatever, and you've got a whole mob chasing you. You use social media in a way that's positive and proactive.
Yeah, I think so, Nick. And I mean, the reality is, you know, I do get lots of abuse on there. I'm a police officer. As I said earlier on about sometimes that people want the police to be seen as the pantomime villain. I expect to get abuse, sadly. You shouldn't have to, but I do. But equally, you get people that what I don't want to do, of course, is I just wouldn't want my inbox littered with how great the police are and how great you are and how great the world is. Mm. So some of it is just it gives an opportunity for. And again, I've had a number of people who've been really, really abusive on Twitter to me, and I'd gone back with it with a response, and it's turned their view around. Now, if you got one in 50 whose view you could turn around through an explanation or outline what you're trying to do, then for me that's success. But you do have to be resilient, trust me. It's you get a lot of stuff where you're ouch.
Yeah, I'm sure. As you know, that we employ a small team of police officers at the university. They're a great asset, and to be blunt, have acted as a deterrent to County Line's gangs who we know like to infiltrate vulnerable student populations. So what's your impression of the relationship between the university and policing in Northamptonshire more generally?
Well, I'll start from a position of we have an outstanding university. The safer that university is, that is great for the county. That is great, puts us on the map for the right reasons. We've had some fantastic academics come out of the university, and long may that continue, and so on. So it is important to me, and I know it's as important to you, that we keep the university as safe as we possibly can. And by putting that small team in the heart of the university allows that free flow of information and intelligence, which allows us to actually get in there and deal with those people who have joined or are in the county for illegitimate reasons. I think the other thing to note is that a lot of students, and certainly in my days when I was at university, quite naive in many ways in terms of the latest technology, the latest gadgets, the latest scams and so on. So having the ability to support the university and the educational piece around what is out there and what people would try to do, I think is vital, and long may that continue, and certainly it will do under my leadership.
Snap.
Great.
That's good.
Great.
Moving on to a really important thing, that you're quite rightly looking into the disgraceful incident of someone putting baked beans on Weetabix. Please, can you A, stop it, but update us on where we are now?
Just absolutely outrageous. I think it's gone from bad to worse, because when I actually started, when I actually put the crime in for the Weetabix and the baked beans, somebody then posted tuna and cucumber on Weetabix. So I don't know whether this is a battle that we're losing, but I tell you what, I'm not going to stop fighting. It's outrageous.
Well, look, you've got 100% support from me, that's for sure. I saw the postcraph and I thought it was disgusting. Nick, many thanks for all of your thoughts and reflections in, you know, the pandemic, a difficult time for all of us. Can we finish off with a record? So tell us what your chosen song is and why did you choose it?
So my chosen record is Dignity by Deacon Blue. And it's one that, you know, I often listen to, certainly when you're going through a really tough time, and you do in police, a lot all police officers do. But the reason that I chose it is because it outlines that this is an individual who set an ambition. He worked hard to achieve that ambition. He wasn't deterred by anybody. He kept going and he actually achieved it. And I think that is a lesson in life for all of us. So that's why I've chosen that one.
That's brilliant, Nick. Thank you so much. And it's been a great to chat to you, and look forward to catching up in the flesh as soon as you possibly can. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you, Nick.
Well, welcome back to NLive Radio. I'm Nick Petford, and today we're talking about policing. I'm joined now by Tim Curtis, an internationally renowned academic and practitioner in the field of social innovation. Tim has worked in environmental policy and law, and community development for governments, major companies, and the third sector. Tim is a program leader at the university and also completing a PhD in community policing with Northamptonshire Police. So, Tim, we're keeping you busy.
Yeah, it's been a busy year. Lots of teaching, lots of going online. I think that's been the kind of the theme of the year, hasn't it?
It has indeed, yeah. So, Tim, you were instrumental in getting changemaker status for the University of Northampton. Can you explain what changemaker is and how your policing work fits in with that?
Yeah, thank you for that. Changemaker, very simply, being a changemaker, I think, is a good starting point, is something for everyone can get involved in. And that's very simply about being able to spot a social or environmental problem in our neighbourhoods, in our schools, in our workplaces, and stepping up and saying, you know, I want to do something about it, and learning the skills and developing experiences that help us to go about tackling those social and environmental problems that we see, rather than expecting someone else to do it. For us as a university, that then has become something related to us as an institution, how we as a university train our students, as well as our staff, of course, but how our students experience that as part of their university degree, regardless whether that's accounting or history or policing or, you know, whatever the degree is, that they experience the way in which their degree studies impact upon society and the environment, and how they learn skills and get experiences that help them become those change makers of the future.
So that impact on society then, I guess, is that where the policing lens fits in well with what changemakers trying to achieve?
Yeah, so, you know, policing is about public safety, isn't it? It's about making communities safer and people feel safe in their homes and on their streets. So that's where the connection is.
Tim, as part of your PhD research, you've developed an innovative toolkit for community decision making with police and community support officers. I mean, this seems to be a great example of what we call action-led research. So how did this come about, and what are the next steps? So, for instance, could this toolkit that you've developed be used more widely outside Northamptonshire?
Yeah, and already is. So I'll come back to that. So this came out of teaching and out of a meeting. I was making a presentation almost a decade ago to local authorities about what was known at the time as joint strategic needs assessments. And I was basically saying that the data that senior leaders in local authorities and health authorities were using wasn't really good enough to find out what was really happening in the streets of Northamptonshire. And they needed to go out and do some real street work. They weren't necessarily wanting to follow that advice. But at the back of the room was this superintendent from Northamptonshire Police. And after the meeting, he came to the campus and had a coffee with me. And that's probably the longest cup of coffee I've had now, because I'm still collaborating with him 10 years later. It's become my PhD, but he is now a retired police officer, and he's doing this work with me across now 14 different projects across a number of different, I'm just looking, five different police forces across the UK. At the time, there was a significant reduction in police resources during the austerity period of public policy. He was being required to reduce his police resources by some 20% year on year. So he needed to reduce his police resourcing, but there was also increasing problems around crime, serious inquisitive crime, burglaries, violent crime on the streets, and apply certain techniques from the social innovation, from the changemaker world, that allowed the community members and the PCSOs and the police constables to collaborate together in new and innovative ways.
So, Tim, when we talk about a toolkit, I mean, is it an online resource? Is it kind of handouts? What is a toolkit in this context?
It is a handbook that was actually written with one of my students at the time, a community development student. I wrote up a handbook, which is available on the intensiveengagement.com website. But it's also a training course and an accreditation process. So, right. Richard James now trains Police officers and community safety partnership members and community members, and we implement it. So we go and do this real live. We're currently in Slough and Banbury and a number of different districts in Somerset and Avon, where we're implementing the projects live with the trainees, and we're accrediting their capabilities and abilities to do this so that they can then go on in their host organisations to implement it again and again and again. So it's about developing their skills.
It's a kind of form of online teaching and learning, isn't it? Or is that making it too simplistic?
Well, it's certainly become online. We started off with kind of flip charts and in community centres and church buildings and stuff like that. And, you know, because this is intrinsically, you know, physical kind of communities, community members getting together and poring over kind of problems, a kind of planning for real type thing. But and of course, in the period of COVID, that's been really difficult for police officers and community safety officers to get out and see people. So we've turned about very rapidly, and we've been doing this on very modern technology, doing online training courses and getting community members collaborating using online techniques. And actually, in some ways, improving police's connection with vulnerable communities by using online techniques. So we're in a situation where you'd expect police forces to be less connected to their communities. We've now managed to help those police forces to improve their connection with communities.
Tim, you're also an Orthodox Christian priest at St Anne's Parish here in Northampton. And how important is this role, both as a guiding principle to you for natural justice, but also more practically in helping understand, and you've touched on this already, Tim, the sensitivities needed in policing a multi-faith community like Northampton?
Yeah, it's an interesting connection. It's something that's, I suppose I've thought about a number of times over the years, and my work as a university lecturer, and then finding myself working in the policing world. It's not something that I've really ever planned to work in. So working now for a decade in the world of crime and criminology and policing, and then as a Christian priest, what's the connection there? And maybe if kind of be a little bit kind of theological and a bit techy here, I suppose this comes down to the nature of personhood. I suppose often when we're working in the field of social innovation, we're trying to solve problems and deal with broken situations. And I find myself a lot facing the situation where all the policies and procedures, all the ideologies and structures that we have and we put in place, really, they stop at a point when we have a person in front of us. When you're faced with a person who's of infinite value, who their personhood comes from being in communion, not just communion with God, but in communion with their neighbor, that their humanness is in relationship with one another. That's the community connection, that we are intrinsically community-based people, and our relationships with one another is vitally important, and every person that we encounter is made in the image of God. So whether that's the person that's in front of us who's really struggling with drug addiction, or a person whom we hate even, whose lifestyle is completely the opposite of us, so all of our policies and procedures, our ideologies, our structures, our plans, all of that kind of falls away when we're encountering that one person. And that one person is still that challenge to us too. And when we're dealing with multi-faith and people who believe different things to us, whether they believe in God or whether they believe in this ideology or that ideology, when we're working in public safety or we're working as public officers and public servants, we've got to kind of somehow brush aside or understand how our policies and procedures meet the needs of that one person in front of us.
It's a very complex and intricate area, Tim.
Yeah, it is.
What have you been doing during lockdown? change the subject.
Yeah, an enormous amount of online stuff. I suppose, you know, this is about, again, about at various levels, how do you build community with students, with my parishioners, with community members of lots of different languages and experiences in several different parts of the UK when you're stuck in your room, in your house, and you're trying to do that via technology. And how do you help people build their confidence and experience? So I suppose that's the kind of, unfortunately, I've not learned how to make artisan bread like my daughter, or learn how to do crochet knitting. I've not done anything really useful like that. I've just sat here trying to figure out how to encourage folk using online technology.
That's great. Well, thanks very much, Tim, for chatting to me. And good luck with the PhD. Oh, is it finished yet, by the way?
All the words are there, and they're not necessarily in the right order. I'm just going doing the last bits of editing.
Brilliant. Okay, well, good luck with that, and great to talk to you as ever. Thank you very much, Tim Curtis.
Thanks very much.
I'm joined now on Shout to the Top here on NLive Radio by Paula Bowles and Manos Daskalou from the university. Paula is senior lecturer in criminology, whose work explores institutional violence. And Manos, also a senior lecturer in criminology, is a specialist in forensic psychology and domestic and sexual violence. Well, welcome both. Paula, can I start with you, please? Paula, in a nutshell, what is criminology?
Okay, there's an awful lot of misconceptions about what criminology is and what it isn't. But in its most basic sense, it's been described by a number of criminologists as a rendezvous subject or an umbrella subject. So we are interdisciplinary. And it is the place where everybody gathers from all different disciplines to talk about issues of crime and deviance. So a lot of people will think that crime is relatively straightforward. It is that that breaks the law. For criminology, the term is much, much bigger than that. So what we aim to do is provide a holistic overview of crime and deviance, looking at it from the perspectives of all parties, whether we're talking about victims, offenders, whether we're talking about institutions, whether we're talking about society itself. So for instance, we can talk about crime like arson, and we can explain that. We can say this man did this and he got this sentence. But what criminal justice cannot do is explain something more complex, such as Grenfell. So in a nutshell, criminology is about trying to understand all aspects of crime, criminality, and criminal justice.
Well, that's really good, Paula. So it's much broader than perhaps people might think, just looking at the title. You know, some people might think, well, it's all about the history of Crippen or Jack the Ripper or something, or some famous criminal, but it's much broader. It's about sociology, it's about psychology, it's about justice in a much wider form. So that's a really exciting definition of what it is. Manos, I mean, both you and Paula do a lot of great work on prisoner rehabilitation. So what are the main challenges and the opportunities in that area?
Well, first and foremost, the issue isn't about prisoner rehabilitation. What we do is prisoner education at a university level, which is quite an interesting idea. When we started it, there were only a handful of institutions involved. Then there is a reason for that. The constituency of prisoners has changed through the times. These aren't only people who are in need of basic literacy and arithmetic. These are people who have multiple knowledge and in some cases even skills. So to go into that environment and teach university level is quite something different. We didn't expect the level, and most importantly, we didn't expect how well it will be received. We were on an inspection, I remember, not so long ago, the prison, and they said that what we have is prisoners, students who are coming to us far more receptive than any other educational program they have had in-house. And some of them wanted to come and observe what we do. And it was very interesting as a conversation, because then we said, well, the main reason this is working is because we use principles or pedagogical principles of equality, respect, and the quality of education, and they do appreciate it. And we started with a handful of people, and we are creating, I would dare to say, even a thriving academic community.
So that's an exciting proposition, that you're actually going in to the jail. I mean, this look, let's be honest, there are some people out there in our community, in our society, that think, look, the prisoners, they're bad guys, they've done something wrong, lock them up, bang them up, chuck away the key. I'm not supporting that. I'm just saying that is a view. And what you're doing, it seems to me, is acknowledging the history of those individuals as they've got through their own lived experience into trouble, into jail, and then helping them by education. So it's more than this rather narrow word of rehabilitation. It's education. And we know that that really pays dividends. Is that, do you think, one of the great opportunities of the work that you're doing?
Absolutely. This combines with, this is what universities were built for, the lifelong learning opportunity, the idea to alter your community from the inside, because education opens doors. And most importantly, it opens and expands the mind. We cannot forget that part of education, the pedagogy that is to set you free through education, to allow you to see beyond, even if you are restricted, and beyond the prison bars and the walls, to see and imagine a world different and see yourself within that world differently.
I think that's massively powerful, Manos. I mean, but Paula, more generally, how does the work that you and Manos do link with policing?
For a lot of people, and this comes back to this misconceptions, they see very little difference between, for example, criminal justice studies, policing, law, and criminology. Criminology is a critique on policing and any form of criminal justice, and indeed law, because if we think about those subjects, they are telling us what is out there. So they tell us what policing is, they tell us what the law is. Criminology asks the question about that would be, what ought it to be, or what could it be, or how could this be different? So much of what we do is looking at those institutions and examining what they do, not necessarily on a case-by-case basis. But for example, there's been a lot of attention the last year with the Black Lives Matters on stop and search, which we know is highly problematic for different communities and is received differently by different communities. So for criminology, one of the big names in our field, Howard S. Becker, argues that we have to be on somebody's side and we can never be on the side of the powerful. So we have a relationship with policing that is positive, but we are distant. We are a critique on what they do and what every other criminal justice agency does.
I get it. So really, it's all part of a bigger jigsaw puzzle, and you fit together in a certain way that allows you to work with the police when you have to. But also, I guess, I don't know, to be a critical friend when you need to be, or perhaps just blatantly critical if you feel that they're getting things wrong. You're both massively passionate about the subject. It's great to hear. So here's a question then for both of you. So what's your history? I mean, what brought you to the university, and how did you get involved in criminology in the first place? So Paula, can I ask you?
Yeah, of course. I had no intention of going to university when I was at school. That wasn't an opportunity. So I came very, very late to criminology as a mature student. And I actually did my first degree at the university. But I think if I have to answer where the criminology came from, I think it came from when I was a kid. I grew up in Tottenham. So against the backdrop of the riots in the 80s. But also I had regular hospital appointments where I had to go past HMP Holloway, yep, which no longer exists. And I often wondered why these people were there and how they were ever going to get out of there. So I think I can take that back to probably when I was about 5 or 6.
I also know the Holloway Jail, actually, because my gran lived on Holloway Road. And so I used to go past it quite a lot. Manos, what's your story? What brought you to the university and what was your path into criminology?
I mean, my mind was different. I was working in prisons. And I remember one day as I was leaving the prison, an idea dawned on me. And the idea was that I haven't spoken to anyone who hasn't got a criminal record today. And I don't know why. I felt quite oppressed by that. And it was perhaps the beginning of me thinking outside. And again, as Paula said, we are critical friends of criminal justice, and thinking, why are we keeping these people here? What is it that we do? What is the benefit? And I started thinking that we need to perhaps change the way we educate ourselves and others, which kind of led me here. Years and years ago when I came, I found this institution to be incredibly important because it's the institution that gives second chances and opportunities to people. we are open for people who are in the wider community. We are giving people the opportunity as mature students to come. We are the University of Widening Participation. Most importantly, we are the university of people whose families never been to university to come to university.
That's true.
We give second opportunities, and the prison is the same.
What are your thoughts then on careers for our students? So criminology, it's a well-respected course nationally. We recruit students to it. They come from all sorts of different backgrounds and different life journeys. What's their career choice then once they've finished with us as a criminology undergraduate?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it is quite interesting because I do get asked that question by parents, by applicants. On open days, we tend to have very, very popular open days. And I say, well, the sky's the limit. But in reality, the best example I can give to people is as follows. You can go, well, when we are not in lockdown, into the middle of Northampton's magistrate court, and you can look around you, and you can see the usher, the police, the probation, the victim support, the young offender team worker. All of these people are our graduates. All of these people have a criminology degree. So all these different professions that make all that universe of the criminal justice system. I mean, it is very interesting, Nick. We just had a session from one of our graduates on cybersecurity. And again, that's one of those many different fields that our students can go, fraud and fraud detection. Numerous other employment opportunities are opened because in the end of the day, everyone has an opinion about crime. Everyone is interested about crime. But most importantly, in our society, we do have and the need to protect and to respond to crime, because in reality, crime does do harm.
That's a really good walkthrough about the opportunities for undergraduates. I guess linking into the research that both you and Paula are doing as well, and that practice-based piece working in prisons with the prisoner education. So it's a fantastic package, I think, that we offer at the university. Well, look, thank you both. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you about criminology. Stay safe and we'll catch up soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, hello, you're listening to NLive Radio. I'm Nick Petford, and today we're talking about policing. And here to broaden out the discussion is my final guest, Matt Callender. Now, Matt is an associate professor and research lead in the Institute for Public Safety, Crime and Justice at the University of Northampton. Matt has led on a variety of research projects, including citizens in policing in the UK and Japan, mental health street triage, and public perceptions of crime and antisocial behaviour. He's also led national surveys of special constables, police support volunteers, volunteer police cadets, and mini police. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, Matt, the focus of the institute that you lead is much broader than just policing, right? And it covers public safety, crime, and justice. Can you give us a bit more detail about the institute, its aims, when it was formed, and who you work with?
The Institute is a research, evaluation and consultancy organisation in the fields of public safety, crime and justice. The Institute was established in 2014 through a partnership actually between the University, Northamptonshire Police and the Office of Police, Fire and Crime in Northamptonshire. And after becoming established, the Institute became more independent within the University. The core mission of the Institute, therefore, is to support positive, evidence-based policy and practice transformation for the benefit of society. And so in terms of the type of work that we do, we have five key portfolios. First, health and justice, which works with a range of partners and agencies. So for instance, we've completed projects around mental health street triage, which involves a partnership between police and Northamptonshire Healthcare Foundation Trust to respond to individuals in the community who are in mental health crisis. The second portfolio is all around children and young people, and so working with children and young people to take a child-centred and creative approach to the kind of research and evaluation activity that we do. So, for example, we've completed national evaluations of the volunteer police cadets and a relatively newer initiative called the Mini Police. This is something that's really interesting and something that's worth having a look at online. I think it's a fantastic initiative, and it's really about building bridges and engaging children in primary school with policing so that they get to understand what policing is and what it isn't. The third portfolio is all around citizens in policing, where we explore and evaluate the roles, functions and contributions of volunteers within policing and public safety. So, for example, we completed a Home Office Police Transformation funded project on citizens in policing to pilot and evaluate innovative models across England and Wales. And we've had some real successes with this area of work. A good chunk of this work was included as part of the evidence base for the Home Office Frontline Policing Review in 2019. And this was also some work where we received an Economic, Social and Research Council grant to explore synergies between the UK and Japan in respect of their volunteering programmes. The fourth portfolio is all around organisational development, so where we're supporting organisations to understand practices, structures and cultures to improve efficiency and lead change. And the final portfolio is all around equality, vulnerability and inclusion, working to empower individuals and communities whose voices are sometimes not heard when it comes to policy and practice change. And so, for example, some of the work that we're currently completing with Northamptonshire Police is an initiative called Citadel, which takes an intelligence-led approach to tackling the harm caused by Class A substances in the county. So overall, we're quite an innovative organisation with quite a wide-ranging portfolios of activity, which we utilise to support the agenda of the university, but we're very much framed within a national and global context.
Well, thanks for that, Matt. So putting this show together, I've been impressed by the amount of research and involvement across the university being done in partnership with the criminal justice system more broadly. I mean, do you think that the Institute, through the Institute and elsewhere, we as a university could be making more of this?
So the first thing I'd say is the university is already doing a lot in the fields of policing and more broadly within the arena of public safety. I feel there's great synergies between the work that we do in the Institute and then in other areas of the university. So for instance, our justice and health portfolio is very much linked with public health specialisms within the university. Our work with the volunteer police cadets and mini police links really well with specialisms in youth development and engagement. And then finally, our organisational development work clearly links with the work going on in the Faculty of Business and Law. So there's a lot of opportunities within the university to develop those relationships and shared expertise. But then there's also opportunities how we could be working better with our local partners in policing and other organisations across public safety. And I also feel there's great scope and capacity to strengthen our relationship and connections and impact more on a national and international scale, given the critical mass of activity that's happening at the university. And so as an institute, we've managed to create some excellent connections through our work with entities like the Home Office, the College of Policing, but also NHS England. And as we continue to grow in the institute, we hope to work more closely with our colleagues across the university.
That's a positive response, and there are opportunities which I absolutely agree with. I think it's an exciting area and perhaps something that the university, as time goes on, could become even more specialised for, if you like, a flagship statement of what the university is all about. Matt, what's your background and how did you get into this, well, policing more generally?
So my background is actually in human geography, but I've always had an interest in public safety. And so I'm not coming from a more policing background or haven't been a police officer in the past. In terms of my research history, when I completed my master's, I explored a youth-centred interpretation of antisocial behaviour at the time when antisocial behaviour legislation was really coming into practice around 2005. But then following that, I completed my doctorate at the University of Northampton, and I started my first postdoc position in the Institute for Health and Wellbeing at the university, supporting a range of public health and clinical health projects. And so one of the main pieces of work that I did was working on the Health and Wellbeing Board public health strategy supporting Northamptonshire to flourish. But then since then, there was this opportunity to move over into the Institute for Public Safety, Crime and Justice, which was something that really linked back to the work that I was completing during my master's. And so I think, you know, my research path, if you like, has been a great example of actually how, you know, you can build a research career by transferring the skills that you learn through your education and through your degree and start applying them in a variety of settings.
So you can switch from one part of the university to another with different levels of expertise and experience and still make a really strong impact. I mean, that's great to know. So Matt, finally, how has lockdown been for you? What have you been up to?
Yeah, so lockdown for me has been actually quite busy, but it also continues to be very busy for a range of partners that we work with across health and policing. So within a research role, obviously there's been quite a lot of challenges, shall I say, around the COVID period in relation to revising research projects in terms of how we deliver them, but also the timelines in which they're operating against. But equally, it's been quite a rewarding period where we've been able to offer our support where possible to our partners. And so an example of that kind of support is with our work with the East Midlands Special Operations Unit around capturing innovation during COVID. And this is where we're able to bring our expertise to support the East Midlands Special Operations Unit as an organisation with how they move forwards. But yeah, for me, it's been quite a busy period.
Well, thank you, Matt. That's been a tour de force through some of the brilliant work that's going on here in the Institute under your leadership. And good luck to it. It sounds absolutely the right thing that we should be doing as a university. So thank you so much for the interview, and I'll look forward to catching up soon.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure to be on the show.
Whatever your views on policing, our officers are working flat out to maintain community cohesion as part of a difficult balancing act in response to COVID. We also heard how research by our university experts is being put to good use, keeping law enforcement and protection centre stage in the county and beyond. Well, that's it for now. Join me next month when our theme is sport, with special guest Kelvin Thomas, chairman of Northampton Town Football Club, talking not just football, but cricket and rugby too. Thanks to our listeners in the UK and the small but hopefully growing number in the South Pacific, and you'll have had to have tuned in to the first show to know what that's all about. Remember, wherever you are, it's gonna be all right. Until next time, take good care of yourself.